This is Radioactive Magazine, KKFI Public Affairs Program, Progressive Activism,
3 seconds.
Commentary. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Okay, thank you for joining us here on Radioactive Magazine. Today, Spencer Graves is doing the interview, and he will start in just a minute, reminding you that it is the pledge drive week. So we hope you will call in with a very generous pledge. We need money to help with our expenses. We are all volunteers, but we still have expenses. We have utilities, rent, power expenses, et cetera. And that costs thousands of dollars every year. So every month, really. So please call in and send a pledge. Show us that you appreciate what we're doing. We'll be back and tell you some more about the pledge after the interview. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much, Greg. Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. We'll be talking with Professors Russell Brooker and Michael Smith on the history of voter suppression. Brooker is the author of a chapter on Black voting rights, 1865 to 2016, two Reconstructions and four Mississippi plans, in a 2022 book, this came out earlier this year, on Much Sound and Fury or the New Jim Crow. He is a professor of political science at Alverno College in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Smith is the chair of the Department of Social Sciences, Sociology, and Criminology at Emporia State, and is the editor of that book, as well as the author of 5 of the 10 chapters in that book. And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And before we go to our guests, I want to remind our listeners once again that this is Pledge Week. KKFI needs money to continue broadcasting. Call 888-931-0901 or go to kkfi.org and click donate in the upper right or ways to give or alternatives. If you do not see ways to give, look for the hamburger icon in the upper right and click on that to find ways to give. I feel a need to explain what your donations pay for. They pay, as Craig said, very little for content. 85% of our 24/7 broadcast hours are locally produced by volunteers like the Radioactive Magazine team. The other 15% are national and international feeds like Democracy Now! That many of you listen to. We broadcast 24/7 at 100,000 watts. That costs money for electricity and to purchase and maintain equipment, both in our broadcast studio and out at the tower. We have a paid staff of 4, 2 full-time and 2 half-time. Right now we're looking for a replacement for our development director, Bill Sundahl, who is now trying to raise money for the Beacon.media. Hooray for the Beacon.media, a local news nonprofit that launched 2 years ago in the midst of the pandemic and has already made numerous important contributions to improving the quality of local media and local government, even, I think. We need people to replace Sundahl, and we need money to pay his replacement. We also need to pay our chief operator, Chad Brothers. The FCC requires us to have a chief operator. Without a chief operator, we cannot be a radio station. Okay, and we have a halftime accountant and a halftime volunteer coordinator, Shana Littler and Daryl Oliver, respectively. So again, pick up the phone, call us at 888-931-0901 or go to kkfi.org and click donate in the upper right. Professor Brooker, what do you mean by two reconstructions?
Thank you. I divided the history of Black voting rights from the end of the Civil War till I stopped in 2016 because things have changed so much in the last 4 years. And I looked at two reconstructions, And the first one started at the end of the Civil War, and it depends which book you read, 1863 or 1866. And in that first Reconstruction, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, and Black voting in the South increased dramatically. And that there were many millions of Black voters, and they elected congressmen, they elected senators, governors, and many local officials. And that lasted about till the end of the century. And historians usually end it in 1877, because that's when the US government stopped using the military to enforce it. But as late as 1898, a Black Republican was elected from North Carolina. His last name was White, just for irony's sake. And then the second Reconstruction is the Civil War, not the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement. And so I didn't think of either of those names. The first Reconstruction was called that. And then the Civil Rights Movement of the 50s and 60s was called the Second Reconstruction, which meant the other one had to be first. And so it lasted in the 50s and 60s, and you can pick whatever dates you want. But the most important aspect of that for voting rights was the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And then that, again, Black voting in the South increased dramatically. And has remained high since then. And so in between those, you had, after the first Reconstruction, something called the Mississippi Plan. And it was called that at the time. And it was in the middle 1870s. And it basically consisted of white Knight Riders, Ku Klux Klan type organizations, not the Klan itself. It didn't exist after the early 70s till the 20th century, but Klan-like organizations. And basically based on intimidation, murder, this violence. And now they backed themselves up with laws to reinforce that. They passed something called the pig law. So if you stole anything costing a price of a small pig, which would be a dollar, you could go to prison for that. Well, you didn't go to prison, you went. Well, that's a different story, but you were treated much worse. And then, that severely reduced Black voting, but did not end it. And so you had the second Mississippi Plan, which is what it was called at the time, starting in 1889. And Mississippi was considered the center of it, because they rewrote their constitution in 1890 to disfranchise Black voters. And so all 11 former Confederate states rewrote or amended their constitutions from 1889 to 1908. And so that was based upon the laws and violence. That was when lynching was at its greatest height. And so the difference between the first and second Mississippi plans was, the first one was basically violence backed up by laws, and the second one was laws backed up by violence. And so, and it remained that way from the end of the second Mississippi plan. The NAACP and other Black organizations fought and were pretty successful until they were very successful in the 1960s. And then the, what I call the third, now I'm the only one who ever called it that, the third Mississippi plan, about 1965, and that did start in Mississippi, okay? None of these were limited to Mississippi, by the way. Okay, the first three started in Mississippi. And so it was not a matter of denying the people the right to vote. There was no vote denial. People could vote, but their votes just didn't count. And so it's called vote dilution. And so that, things like redistricting, gerrymandering, which we're all familiar with, was used extensively. Cities would annex white areas and de-annex Black areas. They would change from districts in an area to at-large elections to make sure only whites won, that sort of thing. Now, Black voting stayed high. That they didn't reduce the Black voting. And then that gave way, and there's no specific year, maybe year 2000, I guess, would be a good, I think in Michael's previous book, I think that's the year he picked. And And then it didn't get rid, did not, they did not stop with voting dilution, but they went back to voting denial. And so you had a lot of efforts to the photo IDs, proof of citizenship, that sort of purges, that sort of thing. And so that, they tried to reduce the black and other poor white votes. But by the way, the poor whites were also hurt in all of this as well. It wasn't a mistake that the people in charge didn't want the poor whites to vote. And so there were many ways poor whites could get out of these restrictions, such as the literacy test. They just could pass the literacy test no matter what, whether they could read or not. But there was a poll tax, and we don't have a poll tax today. It's unconstitutional, but they did in the 1800s. And that was used, and that did not, there was no exclusion for whites in that. And that was $1 or so to vote. And so that's where we are now, that the fourth Mississippi plan is with us today. And that's what the newspapers cover. Now, the fourth Mississippi plan has nothing to do with Mississippi. So if the governor of Mississippi wants to complain to me, she's got a point. Okay. I thought it sounded good. But it's in many states, Kansas, Wisconsin, North Carolina, many other states. So I guess that's my tour of my chapter.
Great. So and as a matter of fact, the case of Fish versus Kobach is a Kansas example of your fourth Mississippi plan. Would you say that?
I think Michael knows that better than I do.
I can speak to that. That was heard together with another less publicized case called Bednosik v. Kobach. I happen to be an expert witness on that. Chris Kobach, who is back and now running for Kansas Attorney General, as you probably know, championed laws passed by the Kansas legislature. This was when he was Secretary of State, calling for proof of citizenship, that one registering to vote in the state of Kansas had to prove that they were an American citizen by producing a birth certificate, passport, Native American tribal papers, naturalization papers, a few other things. Arizona had similar laws, and so did Alabama and Georgia, although they were never enforced in those two states. There was no evidence of undocumented immigrants voting in Kansas election in any systematic way. Kobach got himself made the only Secretary of State in the United States with prosecutorial powers and undertook to find all of the undocumented immigrants voting in U.S. elections. He only successfully prosecuted one Peruvian national who actually was a naturalized American citizen, but he had registered and voted prior to completing his naturalization. So we challenged, arguing that the votes did lower voter turnout, particularly in some African-American and college town communities. Kobach, representing the state, did lose the case. And of all things, his behavior at the trial was so erratic that he was ordered by the judge, who was, by the way, appointed by George W. Bush on a recommendation by Sam Brownback. He was ordered by the judge to take continuing education courses to keep his law license.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. There's a Wikipedia article on Fish versus Kobach. I wrote that article based on Judge Julie Robinson's findings of fact and conclusions of law. She said, what was the number? 39, I think, cases
Those weren't all filed. Those weren't all successful either.
Yeah. And right. And versus 400 people who in his election voter information system that were registered to vote before they were born, like neonatal voting. I don't know if any of them voted, but we need to remind our listeners we've got a champion match of $100. So we hope you will call 888-931-0901 or go to kkfi.org. Craig, do you have something you want to say?
Yes, Spencer. We also have numerous prizes for thank you gifts available. And what you need to do to see what they are, because it's too numerous to say on air, is we're suggesting you go to our website, kkfi.org, and approximately halfway down the page, it says prize closet. Click on the prize closet and you'll see all of the gifts that are available. And there is also a DJ certificate available. And Spencer, I've gave you the two. What's the other one?
I'm sorry, I don't know here.
So the DJ certificate and the day sponsored gift. That's in, those two are in addition to all the other thank you gifts that are on the website. So Spencer, I'll return it to you.
Okay, so how does gerrymandering, so you talked about three methods of voter suppression, of taking, giving or taking away the right to vote. What are those?
The three methods I listed are very generic. One is vote denial. That's simply to make it so people can't vote. And that's very important. In our book, and I've read many other articles and books about this, whether the fourth Mississippi plan is actually reducing the vote substantially is not clear. And so that certainly it didn't seem to have reduced the vote in 2020. And I don't cover 2020 in my book, in the book, but certainly it's the highest turnout in 100 years. But vote denial is one. And I think one reason that it's not as effective as it used to be is that we're denied two of the main pillars of the other time, which was poll tax. We can't have a poll tax. And now we can argue that some of the regulations act like poll taxes, but we don't have an exact poll tax. And we don't have literacy tests anymore. And so that's going to hurt any effort to reduce the vote. The second one, besides vote denial, was vote dilution. And that was gerrymandering is the most famous thing in that, is that you can vote, it just doesn't mean anything. And so in Wisconsin, we have the state assembly, would be our lower house in the legislature, it has 99 seats. And we don't know how the vote's going to go this fall, but we do know the Republicans will have a majority of the seats because they always have a majority of the seats. Because the seats are so gerrymandered. And I think in 2018, the Democrats got 56% of the vote for the assembly and ended up with 34 representatives out of the 99. So that's gerrymandering for you. And the third one is illegal actions, which I mentioned only with the first Mississippi plan. And honestly, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, is this an important, intimidation and theft and all of that, is that important? I would have said, no, that's not important anymore. And we've had many people here in Wisconsin. We had a former Supreme Court Justice, Gableman, who has now spent about $800,000 looking for fraud in the 2020 election and hasn't been able to find it. And I know they did that in Arizona as well. So this illegal action has not been important recently, but President Trump and other Republicans are now saying they're going to have an army of poll watchers and clearly saying they're going to intimidate the voters and they're going to enlist the district attorneys. And they will do what they can to make sure the voting comes out right. And I don't know if they'll be successful because the district attorneys may not want to participate in that. But certainly the effort is going to be made. And I think in the 2024 election, we cannot discount another January 6th. Yeah. But by the way, I'm reading a book on Abraham Lincoln, and there was very great concern that in the 1861 equivalent of January 6th, although it was in February, I think, that something terrible would happen. And they were so worried about it. Nothing did. Nothing did. Nothing has ever happened until 2021. And when the Congress count, the Senate counts the votes.
Right. Right. Well, the speaking of illegal actions, I mean, it's not quite illegal, but it's, I can't remember, in either Kansas or Missouri, they passed a law, or they were, or the, maybe I'm mistaken, someplace I've heard that a state was passing a law, that made it so difficult for the League of Women Voters to register voters that they gave up. What can you tell me about that?
I can address that one. That is still in litigation. Essentially the Kansas League of Women Voters have stopped voter registration drives. It makes it a crime it makes it a felony to impersonate an election official. And the definition of what is impersonating an election official is extremely, well, in my opinion, extremely slippery. Once again, there is no evidence of any type of crimes being committed in registering voters that would justify such a law. So it would appear to be a form of intimidation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So how does gerrymandering fit in with your list of three methods of enfranchisement and disfranchisement?
Well, that's vote dilution. You get to
and,
vote.
And how does it compare in magnitude with the other things that are being done to try to?
Michael can speak to that too, but I think it's probably the most important one. I know that felony disenfranchisement is pretty successful at reducing the vote, right, and shifting the vote more Republican. But I would think that the gerrymandering is most important. But it's sort of like saying which leg is most important on a three-legged stool. You know, I mean, they all work together. Uh-huh. So, Michael?
Well, sure, I'll jump in too. I just reviewed an excellent book called Gerrymandering or Gerrymandering in the States, published by, I believe it was Cambridge. It was several different authors. It was really interesting because they took on a very common argument. You've probably heard this one, Spencer. And this is the argument that, well, Democrats are all bunched up in cities and older suburbs and in states that are heavy with urban areas. And so, of course, when you draw the districts, you're going to have more land in these heavily Republican areas. And that is absolutely true. If you look at a red and blue map of Kansas or Missouri, both states are about 41% Democratic, but yet they only have two or three counties per state that are blue because they're all bunched up in a few places like Jackson County and Wyandotte and Johnson counties. But here's the thing. These scholars found that in states where nonpartisan commissions or Democrats drew the map, there was not any dilution of Democratic votes or votes cast by people of color. It was only in states, and yes, Democrats are all bunched up in urban areas these days, but it was only in states where Republicans drew the maps where the fact that Democrats live where they live resulted in their votes being diluted. So it's pretty clear that it is a political choice. It is not just where Democrats and Republicans happen to live.
Right. You're listening to 90.1 FM, Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We're talking with Professors Russell Brooker and Michael Smith on the history of voter suppression. But again, this is Pledge Week, and we need your call at 888-931-0901 at takes something like $1,000 a day to run KKFI, very roughly, so we need help to stay on the air. We know that a lot a lot of you out there and are enjoying what you get, and you're getting stuff on KKFI that basically the commercial media have a conflict of interest in reporting on. So please call at 931-0901 or go to kkfi.org and pledge. So let me,
if I could,
please.
Something that's changed just in the past couple of years is that in my chapter in the book, it says that all of the voter suppression measures are not targeting absentee ballots. And that's what the literature says up till when I wrote this. And because the Republicans thought absentee ballots tend to go Republican. And they were looking for fraud where it doesn't happen in the in-person voting and ignoring where it could happen in the absentee voting. But since the 2020 election and Biden did so much better in the absentee and the drop-off voting, and Trump did better in the in-person voting, now the voting suppression measures are attacking the absentee and drop-off voting as well.
And that's interesting.
And
Oregon has some states like Oregon only have basically mail-in voting, right?
Yeah.
Right. So and I remember interviewing Penny Abernathy, journalism prophet, University of South Carolina, a couple of years ago. She said that there's the only serious vote fraud she knew about was a case in South Carolina where somebody had some Republican election official or Republican operative had collected a whole bunch of absentee ballots and stuffed them together, you know, and it was all one precinct that had a massive amount of Republican votes, right? that and a local university prof said, that's odd, and started looking at the figures, right? How would you compare the credibility of news from television sources like MSNBC and Fox with the Washington Post and standard refereed academic journals and with court records like the findings of fact and conclusions of law by Judge Robinson?
I might make a few comments. So often in the news media, and I don't mean community radio, we're grateful for community radio, but we tend to focus on the sensational, and a lot of times that means anecdotes. And we have to remember that there are millions and millions of Americans registered to vote. And that's why, as political scientists, what Russell and I and our colleagues did in our book and our other research is we look at the data systematically. We can always produce an anecdote here or there, but systematically, there is zero evidence of widespread voter fraud, period.
Right, right. And that's borne out in Judge Robinson's findings of fact and conclusions of law. They have actual rules of evidence in courts of law that sometimes get enforced. And college profs are worried about the future and getting things right. They're not worried, right? And MSNBC and Fox and so forth, they're worried about attracting an audience and selling audience behavior to funders. Well, I think we're about out of time here. So I think I better thank you all. Tune in next Tuesday to hear Radioactive Magazine host Pat Reilly give a legislative recap with members of the Missouri House. And again, we're asking your pledge for at 888-931-0901. Craig?
Okay, and please do call with the pledge. As we indicated before, we have over 150 volunteers here and only about 2.5 paid staff. 85% of your money goes to all of those expenses. electricity and all that stuff. It all goes into the general budget, not allocated per show, because we don't have per show expenses. But when you call during a specific show, it does tell us that you're listening to that show, and hopefully that this is your favorite show. Spencer and I would be delighted to know that Radioactive Magazine, or for me, Jaws of Justice as well, if want that those are your favorite shows. But listen to all the shows. We have a lot of public affairs shows. I can't mention all of them. Judy Ansel does a great job on Heartland Labor Forum Thursday night. And there's several other wonderful public affairs shows. When you call in, it puts a happy face on Spencer and me. If you don't call, we get sad. So make us happy. If you want to see happy
faces, yeah. And Craig has a great face for radio too. And we still have $100 pledge match, right? Going. So we really need you to call.
If you want to learn something about Spencer and me, on our website, you can go to, there is a bio about every programmer that does the show, or almost every program. And so learn about us and see what we're all about.
And you can write to us at news@kkfi.org with your program ideas and so forth.
And we do this, of course, we're very passionate and we love doing it. So we're doing it for ourselves too, but we're doing it most of all for you, the listener.
I'm doing it because progress on every substantive issue I can think of is blocked, because every countermeasure threatens someone with substantive control over the media. So there's a major problem, and that's why we need you to call. And
so we've got about 30 seconds left. I think, Spencer, you wanted to tell about a rally this.
Oh, yes.
Also, in addition to that, there's two events going on. Spencer, I'll tell you about one. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday is also Pride Fest Kansas City 2022, and it's down at Peace Park.
And there's a MarchForOurLives.org is organizing a rally this coming Saturday, June 11th, starting at 1 p.m. at Gillum Park at 43rd and Gillum Road. Then at 3 p.m., they plan to march to Ties Park at 43rd and Oak, just south of the Nelson Art Gallery. And for more information, you can go to MarchForOurLives, all one word, .org, or look for the description of this episode of Radioactive Magazine at kkfi.org. Click News and Public Affairs, then Radioactive Magazine.